Hey friends, before we kick off today's episode, I just want to mention that certain parts of today's discussion may be triggering to some. So I highly encourage you to read the description and make the right call for yourself. Welcome back to Millennial Musings, and as always, I'm your host Anurag Ramchandran. On today's episode, we have an incredibly special guest. Havovi Wadia is the CEO of Save the Children India and has previously worked at such revolutionary organizations such as Child Rights in You as well as Magic Bus India Foundation. Basically, when it comes to child and adolescent rights in India, very few people can claim to have Havovi's experience and expertise. And so I'm thrilled to have her on today's episode to talk about everything pertinent to child and adolescent rights and well-being in our country. So without further ado, let's jump straight into the episode. Thank you for tuning in to Millennial Musings, and I hope all of you have a tremendous new year. For the longest time, at least for the past decade or so, we've been hearing a lot about the demographic dividend in India, how youth are the future, how our youth, we're going to be, you know, the engine for change in our country and, you know, bring it to the economic heights of several of the other Asian and, you know, Western counterparts that we have. Yet, oftentimes, I notice that we let our conversations kind of slip away when we talk about children and children's rights and the kind of impact that they can have as the future of our country. So my first question to you then is, what do you think are some of the most left out topics when it comes to children and education and child rights that we don't really focus on when we talk about this great economic potential that we have before us?
So Anurag, for me, the first thing that I think we need to get over is this notion of children as an investment. The idea that we will do things for children today so that they will do things tomorrow or 5 years from now or 6 years from now is really abhorrent to me. The notion of children's rights is that as a child of 2 or 8 or 12 or 17 and a half, you're a citizen today and you have rights today. And those rights accrue to you by virtue of being born in a particular place. That's it. That's the end of the discussion. There is no other discussion on this. And yet, and I think this is the way, the instrumental way in which we think about children, about adolescents, even about women. I think these are part of the reason why the so-called demographic dividend hasn't been reaped in India. Because we've recognized it only at a time, and we've begun to work on it only at a time when it is imminent. And You can't start working with somebody at age 17 or 18 or with a demographic like 5 years before it's going to hit its peak and then say, you know, why, what did we do to lose out on this opportunity? I find the entire approach, I feel that it lacks foresight, you know, it lacks investment in people for people's sake. There's an instrumentality to it, like I said, and I think that's the root cause of why we're not able to serve people or to enable people to in the way that we should be able to in, you know, the 21st century. I'm sorry, that's a long starting point, but I just really wanted to make that first. The second thing is, I think with regard to the question that you ask about children and what are the things that slipped through, you know, There's all kinds of things that slip through. The way that the funding for the sector gets structured and public policy discussions get structured, there are trending topics, very much like Twitter. And those trends last for 5 to 10 years, sometimes longer. So the HIV trend lasted 2 decades in the last century. Right. And then just petered out as if it's not a problem anymore. But HIV, the repercussions of living with HIV, other people impacted by HIV, these continue to be problems, including children who have HIV or children who are in families where somebody has had HIV, as a result of which the child doesn't get what she or he needs, etc., etc. So that topic has gone from the scene now suddenly. But that problem for children has still remained. So that's one example. And the other example, of course, is children with disability. A child with disability may be like 3% of the every, so 3 in every 100 children may be disabled, you know. I'm saying because that number is so seems so small. And because once you say this child is disabled, then there are so many different kinds of disability, and it's so nuanced and so, you know, not conducive to a discussion on scale or any of the other nice things that people want to talk about
right.
when we're solving social problems. So children with disability inevitably get left out. And on that front, my worry is always that policy, language, discussions, conversations, they are in another, on another planet. And what happens on the ground is, it's like another, it's a century ago, you know, right. and I, that's another, those are the other kind of children who perennially get left out, no matter what the trend is of the time, the child with disability will get left out. So if it's children with HIV, then children who have disability who are living with HIV will get left out. So for me, that's a, it's a big learning, and it has been a big learning in the last few years, that these children just tend to, you know, slip, we tend to let them slip out through the cracks in conversations. And then there are other conversations. So children, for example, we have this large conversation going, and it's been in, going for now 20 years, about how we need to do things about children who are in, are out of school. And right. starting from Shanta Sinha to Kailash Satyarthi, and all our, you know, significant campaigners have been talking about child labor. There are, again, child labor is a larger story, and the smaller stories within that sometimes don't quite get attention. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, children who are enrolled in school but never attend school. Yeah, that's right. And why they don't attend school. Children who are part of families who go, who are part of the mining sector, who are part of the construction sector, or children who are trafficked, children who are in institutions. I mean, this, it's such a large, it's a wide, such a wide canvas, such a large number of children whose problems we just don't talk about. I mean, I could go on about this for a really long time, to be very right. frank. Right. Anurag, can I tell a small story here?
Please do, Havavi.
May I?
Yeah.
I just wanted to share something that I, that came to light recently. And again, it's a personal experience. And mm-hmm. I just thought about it while talking. So this young girl, she is now 16. She's the daughter of the lady who does the cooking in our house.
Okay.
It so happens that our building overlooks the camp, the labor camp, where they used to live 12 years ago when they began, when they first came to Bombay. So mm-hmm. I learned recently that the two or three families had traveled here together. And I learned recently that one of the women stopped doing domestic work because she couldn't bear to have to do to her children what the other women were doing. So the men would go to work in the labor camp. The women would go to do domestic work because that paid better than the labor camp.
Right.
And the children would be locked in houses. And this woman basically couldn't bear to hear her child crying every day when she locked him into her house. And so she chose wow. not to go to work, and she chose to stay at home and look after her son and things like that. And in a very short time, she just packed her bags and went back to her village in West Bengal. Mm. And I was thinking how I live right here. I work in children's rights. I committed to this issue. And I didn't even think about the problem. And recently when she was telling me, she said, the reason I didn't want to do domestic labor is that we are not allowed to bring our children to work. But if I had gone to the labor camp, they would have done something for my child. They would have taken care of my child there. But I couldn't manage that kind of work. And you know, so this, it's this kind of thing that I'm talking about. How difficult growing up is,
right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, long answer to the question.
No, this is very pertinent, Havavi. And I think the example kind of hit the nail right on the head where it comes to how often, how out of sight and out of mind children's rights and children's issues are. So I was just wondering then, in situations like this where your economic circumstance kind of dictates how children grow and, you know, their access to education and access to rights for that matter, or knowledge about all these rights, what have you seen are some of the biggest barriers for, you know, children to kind of bloom into whoever they should become, given like the economic constraints that are around them are often so constraining, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I think we've seen a few things, and this is again not just, you know, me personally, but also all the work that the organizations I've been working with have done.
Right.
You know, a big part of it is the kind of work your parents do. So it's not about just is it informal or formal work, but within informal work, what kind of work is it, right? Is it lower down on the hierarchy of labor or a little bit higher on the hierarchy of labor? Are you getting paid like 400 rupees a day or are you getting paid 700 rupees a day? All that kind of thing. I think that's one big thing. And particularly with mothers, what do mothers get exposed to? That's a big thing. I've also realized how big a role women play, not just, I mean, so again, of course, there's all this data that says, right, you educate a woman, a girl, and then if for every extra year of secondary education that she gets, she continues in school for, there's a 5.5 times less likelihood of her getting married as a child. That's what the data says. But it's not just things like that. You see, I've noticed that even women who don't have a lot of education or have barely any education, some of them are extraordinarily strong. And they recognize the environment that they are in and make a set of decisions which move their children forward faster than another set of decisions might. And again, I'll share this via a story, right? So this lady, again, migrant into Bombay, is her first child is a daughter. Her child is very dark. And at age 6, she tells me, my child is very dark. I need to save up because I'll need to give her a big dowry. And so I'm going back, I'm earning here and I'm going back and I'm going to buy gold every year to put away for her so that she doesn't have to compromise on marriage later. Wow. Now, do I disagree with this? Well, obviously, I mean, there's no conversation about this.
Absolutely.
But this person knows the system that she belongs to, and she's planning this far ahead. Then this lady goes ahead, enrolls her child in a school, there's domestic violence in her home. She faces that domestic violence, but continues to keep her child in school. Her child is right now on the verge of completing secondary school.
Wow.
You know, so even sometimes the struggle that I have is to say what kind of intervention works when I can see that so much of it is just, do you have what kind of effort do you make? And even this, even as I say it, I cringe because this lady, this person I know is quite a hero and quite a strong woman and various things like that. And you shouldn't have to be that to just educate your child. You shouldn't have to be exceptional. I was listening to a conversation with Sarvesh, right? And the story about his mother, for example.
Right.
You shouldn't have to do all that. You shouldn't have to leave your home or, you know, or to educate your children, to give your children a better life or any of that kind of thing. But this is the world that we live in. So individual strength, resilience, courage, all that counts for so much. And then there is one thing I think I have to say in response to that, which is there's a kind of untold social capital which comes from your friend circle, your whom you are influenced by, those whom you influence, the behaviors that you see as desirable in your environment, the behaviors that get reinforced, all that kind of intangible stuff either helps to push people forward or pulls them back.
What essentially we were talking about is the rigidity of systems that exist in place, that regardless of, you know, whatever progressive thought we may have or whatever ideas of progressive, you know, action that we might have, be it education, be it, you know, like not competing with, not engaging in dowry, you know, having equal access to everybody. So there exists a world in which all these are the right things to do. All these have to be done and everybody has to be given, you know, access to all of these. That's an ideal world that we aim for or look forward to, at least in the sectors that you and I work in. But on the other hand, there is a lived reality and lived experiences of people like Sarvesh's mom and, you know, your contact that you just talked about. And I feel like there's this constant tension that exists between the ideals that, you know, the development sector stand up for and talk about and encourage, while at the same time, the rigidity of maybe the caste structure or systems or dowry or, you know, fairness in this case, the example that you talked about, that continuously compete with these notions of equality that we're trying to push. So how do you try to push forward these ideals when the system is so rigid, and how do we get the system to be less rigid so that we can, you know, aspire for a world in which this really doesn't happen?
Yeah, such a big question, nah? Such a big question. Right. It's I think that there is so much work to be done with the middle class, to be honest, because the middle class or the elite of the country, theirs is the reality that gets portrayed everywhere as the ideal, the thing to follow, right? In, whether you're looking at popular culture in any form, things like that. So it's really important for us to influence this class of people, because whether we like it or not, they land up setting the bar for the rest of the country in terms of aspirations. And I was at CRY and many years ago, and this is the work that we were mandated to do, some of us in a small team, which was, can you work with the middle class to help the middle class understand what we call the middle class, which is the literally like your upper middle class and upper class. But basically, can we work with them to help them help us all recognize how in our everyday there is a taking for granted of the color of your skin, of the way you speak English, of how you what your probable caste is, probably what community you belong to, you know, all that kind of thing. So I think the work to be done is with all of us.
Correct.
The intervention for this is with all of us, because in the way we invisibilize, in the way we take for granted, is the biggest problem, right? And again, that's why I heard the whole of Sarvesh's conversation exactly for this reason, because he raised this question about how we speak English and how that defines what we get access to in the middle class, right? And then we will talk about doing, you know, multilingual education in our national education policy. All everyone wants in this country is to be able to speak English and to get access to the kind of life that all of us live right now. And I'm saying, if that's what people want, and if English is their vehicle to a more equitable world, then let's do it. Let's make it accessible. Then people decide or don't decide, that's their choice, you know. But will we make it accessible, or will we continue to keep it as, you know, this, you know, like a bastion of metropolitan India or urban India at the most? So I think that work, A, the work to be done is with the middle class, and B, I think there is, we have to accept that there are some markers of egalitarianism, which everybody simply must have access to. So, for example, digital literacy, I don't care what we say about the internet, it's right now, it's a human right. You need to have access to technology. Even basic technology, this needs to be seen like that. You know, that kind of thing, the access to a some kind of quality English speaking English education or whatever. I think that these are really critical things. And again, I mean, I was listening to somebody yesterday present about how his entire life changed when he read Ambedkar's Annihilation of Caste, and then got introduced to what Kanchiram did. I was thinking, my God, we don't learn about these guys.
Yeah.
Why don't we learn about these guys? And if I had learned about them, would I have been different? No. Would I have thought different? Would I have had a more empathetic view of the world? You know, and I mean, I feel right now the need to ask these questions is so urgent. And even if they lead to long rambling conversations, those conversations are essential, because otherwise we're not going to move anywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I completely agree with you on that. But what I also see is the biggest constraint to having that kind of equal access is the, you know, big barriers to entry. Like, we're talking about digital literacy and access to that kind of education. We also see a world in which it is extremely monetized. You know, we're talking about all these billion-dollar apps now coming out of the woodwork, right? You have the Baijus and White Hat Junior and firms that have, you know, companies that have existed for less than a year, you know, being sold for billions of dollars. And you found a world in which, you know, the capital markets and the markets that have recognized that there is this gap in digital education, making it a very high barrier for entry, because obviously not everybody can afford, you know, to buy these apps and pay monthly, you know, for these classes, and monetizing that. And now you're already seeing there exists a massive, not just the barrier to entry, but there's a quality difference as well, right? So you have these private companies pumping in huge dollars and making it of a certain quality and then selling it to the public for a really high cost. And then you have a government, for whatever reason, is lagging behind, right? And we can go into those reasons, you know, for an entire episode, but it's lagging behind. And then you, again, what we end up with is a world in which some people have access to those who have traditionally had access to quality education. And so, you know, they keep moving forward, and others still are, you know, held away from having that kind of access. But we're still talking about a tool that is supposed to be easily accessible to everybody, right? Like in a country in which Wi-Fi is easily accessible now, and you know, you can get all these technologies, you still have these divides happening. And so I know I just rambled on a little bit because that's my frustration with the kind of sector you know, interventions that we're seeing. But I'd like to bring our conversation back maybe to children and childhood, and then let's tackle these questions about like what the sector is doing and what we are experiencing. But Habubi, maybe from your experience, because you've spent so many years working so closely with children, and observing childhood and how that evolves into, you know, adolescence and then into adulthood, can you maybe talk a little bit about what are some of those big challenges that children face in that transition from being a child to an adolescent and then eventually, you know, being thrown out into this, you know, wide world that we live in?
Yeah, it literally is that. It is literally a throwing out, actually. It's, I think there are two or three things I think that need to be said on something like this. The first is that childhood is a process, right? It's a age 1 to 8 or 0 to 18 process, consisting of multiple transitions. And each of those transitions is not a transition on one thing. It's in several domains. So for example, when I transition from age 6 to age 7, or actually the early childhood you know, bracket is age 8. So when I transition from early childhood to middle childhood, so age 8 to age 9, there are physiological changes, emotional changes, there are changes in my control over cognitive changes, right? So in terms of my control over language, etc., etc. There's also a way that I relate with my peers that changes, and a way that relates with my parents that changes. Right. And it's a transition. It starts perhaps at 6 and it, you know, finishes at perhaps 10 or so. And then before you know it, I'm beginning on another transition. So it's a period of constant evolving, right? That's what happens with childhood all the time. And yet, our ways of dealing with children are flat. So we, for example, and I've noticed this even more once I've become a parent, you know, that our fundamental engagement with children is that of control, whether we want to, you know, accept it or not. Even in class, you sit in that place and you do what I'm telling you to do right now. And this is the beginning of the whole, whatever, Foucauldian, you know, indoctrination to this whole discipline and punish kind of whatever worldview. But we do that in our individual relationships with children as well. So when children don't listen to us, and this is liquid the language, right? When children don't listen to us, then we have ways of making them listen, put you in the corner or whatever, whatever. But that is not something I would ever do, right, with a 25-year-old.
Correct.
So why is it okay for me to accept the agency of a 25-year-old but not the agency of a 6-year-old? I don't know the answer to that question. But I think that's one of the big things that we have to discuss. So there are two things already I've said. One is that transitions happen in multiple ways at multiple levels.
Right.
The second is that as a whole, for children and childhood, most of us, and there are exceptions, but most of us see this phase as a phase where the overwhelming need is the need to protect. And actually, that's simply a really pretty way of saying that I want to control you. Correct. So we basically remove all agency from children and from childhood. So that's the second thing. And the third is that I want to talk about specifically about adolescence, which is the point at which I think children stop being children in many people's minds. So if you ask, and I was doing research on this at some point, just asking, so at what point do you think a child stops being a child, right? So people say, oh, when she or he is capable of doing things on their own, so maybe 7 or 8. And then people say, no, maybe, you know, jab wo syani ho jayegi tab. तो सैनी हो जाएगी का क्या मतलब है, मतलब उसका वही मतलब हुआ ना कि जब वो मच्योर होना शुरू होती है, उसके पीरियड जब शुरू हो जाएंगे, मान लीजिए, या लड़के के बाद, मतलब when they, you know, when hair begins to sprout on your son's face or something like that. So as soon as you hit the stage at which you go from being a child to being a girl or a boy, at that stage the way the world sees you begins to change. But it changes really interestingly. It changes in that you become sexualized, right? But still you're not granted any agency.
Right.
And there is this activist, you know, in Rajasthan who makes a really good point and talks about how child marriage is actually simply about control and caste. Because what my concern is that my daughter will meet someone, will probably have sex or will be interested in, you know, sexual relationships, and will go off with somebody who is not from my caste. So my blood will go outside of my caste. Corrupt ho jayega, matlab.
Right.
So she talks about it, you know, in that light. So I think that this is the third thing, that the transition into sexuality and our really incomplete understanding of childhood sexuality, which is the sexuality of children below the age, below, before puberty.
Correct.
Our lack of understanding of this makes us think that childhood is unsexualized, and therefore when, you know, that whole coming into being of the sexualized entity happens, then you are just so thrown by it, na? So this is why people say things like, "Arey, wo 16 saal ki hai, lekin lagti to hai 24 saal ki."
Correct. Matlab, and that's inherently sexualizing them, like,
totally.
So, yeah.
And just from there, just a small hop into the whole world of trafficking.
Correct.
And the trafficking of minors, and how when you rescue a minor from trafficking, judges, prosecutors, everybody will look at the child and make a judgment on her. Basis her body, basis her language, basis her body language, basis how she looks at you. And forget that the bottom line is she's 16 years old.
Wow.
And she has been violated, right?
Yeah.
And this is the stuff that's really just...
No, absolutely. And I want to move towards the conversation around trafficking and, you know, child sexual exploitation in just a little bit. But when you were talking about these three points about the continuous evolutions that children are going through and the lack of agency, there's just something that I was thinking through this, and there's something that just doesn't sit right with me, right? Like, we're thinking about, okay, we need to be as supportive to children at a younger age, and as they grow up, you know, the idea is that once you become an adult, you know, they get a little more agency than they're used to or whatever. However, it's not a linear process though, right? Like, what we observe is that, okay, in childhood, while there's less agency, there's also a slight amount of, like, control is a little limited as compared to when adolescence hits in, especially for women. When adolescence kicks in, girls especially, what we notice is that the control increases, agency decreases, and suddenly you're shut off from the world or you're exposed to the world almost entirely, you know? And so then once you become an adult, the idea is, okay, once you've married and once you're a proper adult and once this happens and once that happens, you get a little more agency. But we don't even see that. And so that linearity doesn't exist. And it's not just like, okay, you'll get a little more agency as you go through the process of getting older. In fact, it's like ups and downs, and you get held here and you get a little more freedom there and then no freedom at all. And that's just such a weird thing to experience, especially as a child, as an adolescent, when you're going through the process, when you're just confused as to what am I allowed to do and what am I not allowed to do.
Yeah. And we wonder why adolescents are so resentful of everyone, you know. You're absolutely right. It's not linear. And it's not linear, and B, it's not the same for everyone. So there's this study on young people in the UK, and the basically what the researcher did was she observed how people responded when a group of 5 or 6 people walked towards them, right? So let's say I'm walking on the road, a group of 5 or 6 people is laughing and having a good time among themselves and walking towards me. And she said the instinctive, the first thing people think is not, oh, these are children, these are young people having a good time. The first thing people feel is fear. So this is how we look at young people, groups of young people. And then, of course, you're absolutely right, because it was a UK, it was about race. So the color of the skin mattered, the hairstyle mattered, the clothing mattered. In India, it's about, or actually in many parts of the world, it's about, is it a group of girls? What are they dressed like? You know,
yeah.
What time is it? Where are they? What are they doing? You know, absolutely, you're absolutely right. The agency, I mean, paradoxically, control is even more of adolescents than it is of young children. Absolutely. And this is just really the thing that is that I think as soon as she becomes female, explicitly female, something changes.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good time to kind of talk about the trafficking side of things as well, because what we observe is, as you said, as soon as this transition starts to happen, regardless of age, unfortunately, what we notice is that there's this tremendous sexualization that happens of children, which leads to trafficking, which leads to, the kind of terrible world that we live in. And I was listening to some podcasts recently, which talked about the journey over the years with the evolution of technology and the evolution of access to technology, how we've seen even more cases of child sexualization, be it over the internet or, you know, videos being shared of child sexual abuse online, or even trafficking happening even more frequently than it used to be in the past. Or maybe there just wasn't enough tracking back then. I'm not sure, but I think, given the kind of work that you do at Save the Children India, I would love to hear more about what are some of the trends that you're observing, especially when it comes to like child sexual exploitation and trafficking. And maybe we can even go on to have a conversation about some of the work that you're doing to try and prevent this from happening as much.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to talk about, you know, because you're really confronted with the most gory part of human nature. You know, in this thing, and our teams tell simply horrific stories of the age at which children get put onto the market, quote unquote.
Right.
You know, and the sums of money that are fetched for the first set of customers that children are supposed to, you know, who children are foisted with, so to speak. And it's a really important for us to accept that this happens across the country, that it doesn't happen just, let's say, in Madhya Pradesh or just in Rajasthan, right? It's happening across the country. And that trafficking happens traditionally from smaller pockets of deep vulnerability and, you know, generational exhaustion, really, with, you know, poverty and its challenges, happens from there into places like Bombay, Delhi, Nagpur, you know, even Jaipur. Any place, Goa, we know all this. The thing that we are seeing, of course, with the onset of technology, there are so many insidious ways in which trafficking can be done, right? So there are messages and phone calls and photos, and suddenly it's all taken care of and money is transferred and it's all finished, you know, it's done. So many times family members are instrumental in this process. And that's, I think, the greatest point of betrayal for many girls.
Right.
Family members, promises of work, promises of marriage, promises of education, whatever. All this is just, this doesn't change. The only thing that has changed is the medium through which it is done, which is either the email or and or phone calls and lots of photo exchanges and things like that, right?
Right.
It's a bazaar, you know, so what can I say? It gets treated like that. It's completely capitalist in its own way. And people in power in the village will always, or in that area or whatever, will always have first access. So that's even more difficult to accept. In some areas, there is a settlement outside of the village perimeter, you know, where communities live, who we say are into intergenerational sex work, you know. I sometimes I wonder whether that's our nice way of shirking responsibility for what has happened to a community of people, right? They were not traditionally into sex work. They may have been into whatever, maybe dancing, you know, or maybe something else. And yeah, so there's that whole aspect of technology is a big one. the other thing that happens a lot, you know, is how, and I think this is where the system has become a bit better. Mm-hmm. There's a whole chain of people, right, in the trafficking business. And we have to understand that next to arms and drugs, this is the biggest business in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's the third largest business in the world. It's called trafficking in persons. And that can happen, of course, for sexual exploitation, for labor, for anything else. And trafficking of people is as old as, I mean, it's slavery, right? It's that trend. What we are also seeing is a very sophisticated handing over processes, you know. So there are so many people in this trail, from the point at which the girl is sourced to the point at which to the destination point. There are so many stakeholders involved mm-hmm. that even if the system catches the pimp and the, you know, and the front those who frontline this business, they will never catch the rest of the trail. And the rumors are rife in the country right now about how high up that trail goes. That trail has just become more and more sophisticated. It's run like a large conglomerate. And we have a colleague at STCI who keeps saying, look, this is an organized crime. We need to have an organized response to it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else. It's not a social problem. I'm sorry. She keeps saying it's not a social problem. It's a criminal problem. And if we don't engage with it as a criminal problem, then we're doing disservice to all the women and girls that we're working with. The ways in which the system responds, Anurag, it's just completely inadequate.
Yeah.
Partly it's because technology still hasn't made it to the system. So the traffickers are like light years ahead of the system, right? Police, for example, just don't have access to the kind of technology that they need to get to track people and, you know, resources. They don't have access to resources. Just for example, some police work with us because they know, or work with any NGO because they know that if the NGO comes on the raid, at least they'll get a vehicle to travel in.
Wow.
You know, it's it's that kind of stuff. So you're actually, the way we treat our people in the system is getting reflected in the way they treat other people.
And why do you think, Havavi, an issue that is so, like in my thinking, it's an issue that is bipartisan, right? Like it's something that shouldn't be political. It's an issue that everybody in the country should feel shameful about, that this is so prevalent in our country. It's something that can bind us all together. Yet we find cops that are, completely under-resourced, as you said, you know, even looking for a ride to the location along with other NGOs. You're finding that NGOs are not getting funded enough in these cases because these topics are a little more difficult to address and to see immediate changes and all of that. Why do you think there is, regardless, in my mind, it's like is clear as night and day, you know, it's like so clear that this is an issue that has to be invested in, that we have to strengthen our resources and our legal system to help kind of put an end to this, modern slavery in many ways. Yet we find that it is the very issue that gets almost, you know, not as much funding as some of the other more sexier issues, if you may. Why is that the reason?
I think actually there are quite a few people doing excellent work on trafficking in India. They just don't get that kind of publicity because the topic is sordid, not as elevating as a narrative about skilling, for example. And it puts you in touch with a very sordid part of human nature. But there are people in the country doing astonishingly good work, you know.
Right.
And STC has worked with so many of them. So we, for example, Sanjog does wonderful work.
Hmm.
And in Mumbai, of course, Preeti Patkar and Prerna do such good work.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there are people like Angan and Arpan, the International Justice Mission, all of us are doing this and have been doing this for so long. And it's remarkable remarkable how good this sector is programmatically. I find it really sound in many ways, many different perspectives, of course, and different ways of going about the work, but very sound programs all in all. But the reason why it doesn't get funding, I think, is two things. One, ask me to tell you how many girls are trafficked every year in India, how do I give you that number?
Right.
We will only know as many as we rescue, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be undercoated. So right now, this just I recently read a study where the number is cited as about 27,000 girls in Maharashtra. Who will give you money for that CSR right. money? When we're talking about, you know, 6 lakh children on one side and, you know, some big, big number. Same problem as it is with children with disability. I think it's the same thing. I think because we don't see it, we don't realize the scale of it. We don't realize the severity of it. We think it's a niche problem. We think hamare yahan nahi hota hai, kahin aur hota hai. Unki galti hai, unki maa hi aisi hai. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Kind of victim blaming almost in many ways.
Yeah. Oh, victim blaming is rife. Rife.
So rescue is one thing. And then there's rehabilitation that is of utmost importance. What are ways in which young women and young girls and boys and men for that matter who are trafficked or are victims of child sexual abuse, what do you think are ways in which rehabilitation should be done in an ideal system?
We're actually working on some of that, Anurag. So all of us believe very strongly that for minors, it has to be as far as possible, a completion of education. So to the secondary level, the state should be able to support that girl child to complete her education. So grade 10 or grade 12, whatever is, you know, whatever she would like to do.
Right.
That's first. The second is that there has to be some kind of skill building. And unfortunately, many of us in the system still think about skill building as something, you know, being sewing or embroidery or cutting, pasting something. This is not what girls want. And right. It's not what they need. So they will need exposure to employability skills, English speaking, digital literacy, you know.
Yeah, 21st century skills for that matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're going to go out into the world and they don't want to be stuck with this tag for the rest of their lives, right? Now they just want to get on with it. So entrepreneurship skills, and these are things that we do everywhere. So I think this whole bucket of employability and skilling is a very, very important part of rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing that we think and we are increasingly accepting is possibly as important as these two is the whole aspect of building a support network. Do they have friends they can speak to? See, I'll tell you what, a lot of them may not want to talk to us once they've gone back to communities, right? Because then there's a stigma attached to it. So, but is there a WhatsApp group of all of them together where you're just like, you know, girlfriends like we are? How do you build that social capital for them through relationships with each other? How do you collectivize? How do you enable them to stand up for other women like them, perhaps, or to train another person, be peers, buddies, whatever it is? That whole element of building social capital, I think, should be the third part of rehabilitation. For us, and we believe this more and more, rehabilitation has tended to end when the child finishes with the institution. We feel very strongly that we have to do work with communities where children will be rehabilitated.
Yeah.
Not because you can't, of course, disclose the identity or the, you know, where the child has come from, things like that. But also to build just a little bit more gender-friendly environments where children will go in, you know, work with communities to question some basic things which make treatment of women in a certain way acceptable. Because when girls get out of, you know, let's say of the institution, they go back into whatever community or society or village or whatever you want to call it. And if they're exposed to a lot more violence, that's just not going to, that's not rehabilitation, right? So I think it's important to check out the home that she's going to go to, what the network is that she will be part of, everything like that. It's a long process. And I think, you know, for example, in the adoption sector in India, when you adopt a child, even after you adopt, you continue to be accountable to the state for 7 years. The state follows up with you for that long.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of thing, the commitment that we need to make for children and institutions as well. That rehabilitation needs to be, you have to check in with the girl for that period of time, for a long period of time.
Absolutely, because that trauma is not going to just go away with a few days or months or even a couple years of, you know, whatever support is given. It has to be, it has to be elongated and for a long period of time.
Yeah, and it comes up in different ways, right? Trauma has a way of manifesting in different ways. It influences your relationships for a long time. But I'll tell you something, really honestly, a lot of these girls, they're just sick and tired of talking about it. They just want to get on with it, and they want to have a, they want to talk about things other girls talk about, the movies or the, you know, the studies or who said what, you know. They do want to have this normal lives, and sometimes I wonder whether we are guilty of only seeing them as survivors. But they're not just survivors, right? They're also girls who are 17 years old, right?
Correct, correct.
And as a girl of 17, you've got so much on your mind. And once they get over the initial hostility towards the system and things like that, you know, Anurag, I'm telling you, it's something else, because their response to the world is so joyful and open and interested and engaged. And then you have to meet that. If that's the response to the world, and if I'm standing at the age of 17 and saying, this is what I want from my life, then the system has to be able to give that. And I think that's where we NGOs should play like a even larger role. It's just that this work is person by person. It's not a scale task, you know? It's a person by person job.
And I'm so glad you mentioned scale, because this is a constant debate that I have with myself and also others that I've had on the show, and just, you know, being a development sector person, is this whole concept of scale. I have a like a massive love-hate relationship with, and mostly on the hate side of things, especially because in our sector, scale can mean one of, in my opinion, two things, right? One is that it's like a touch and go. Okay, you quickly do something and then, okay, just get a lot of people so that, you know, you can get more funding because you've reached X number of people and whatnot. And the other way you look at it is that you, I mean, it's a way to kind of shirk responsibility almost, because I feel like if the goal is to create actual impact, that it is important to not look at scale as much as the quality of intervention that you're, you know, giving to the community or people involved. And it's a constant debate that I have, because I know some organizations that do great work at scale. But at the same time, I know a lot of organizations that struggle because of the demands of scale that are put on them by large foundations that are supporting them, you know, big donors and whatnot. And it takes away the quality of impact completely. I just want to pick your thoughts on scale. And scalability as the leader of an organization that's doing great work. I just want to know what you think about scale, because I'm sure that scale is the goal, but also that quality is another goal that, you know, is almost at odds with this idea of getting scale at scaling quickly.
Yeah, the thing is now, Anurag, I don't see them as different things. I think it depends upon the social problem that you're trying to fix. If you're trying to fix the problem of learning levels in India, then you can't be niche. You have to fix it at scale, because the problem is at scale. That's the problem that you have. And the my worry is there, I'll tell you, and I'm being really honest here. So for example, I don't think we should be encouraging people to come up with new remedial learning programs. There is so much evidence already in the country that a certain kind of remedial programs, like what Pratham does, for example, teaching at the right level, there's evidence that it works. So take it now, do it. Don't sit and reinvent that wheel. There are other problems to solve. For example, there is, it's true that children across the country need a certain kind of life skills. You've got 3-4 large organizations who do that job really well. Figure out a way and get that to work at, you know, they're doing it at scale anyway. You can take it further, for example. Enrollment for girls in school, ensuring that all girls go to school. You know, Safina and her team have...
Educate girls have done great stuff.
Why would I try to do something else when they've done it?
Right.
Why wouldn't I, you know, just pick that up and say, look, can I do this in whichever area I'm working in? Like, let's say Odisha or wherever, maybe Maharashtra, I don't know. But there are other, so those are the things that I think are issues of scale. Even within those, even within the larger issue of ensuring that every girl goes to school, there are smaller pockets. Right? Those will get left out when you're working at scale. That's where you need people with specialization. So, for example, the enrollment of girls with disability. Or the enrollment of girls who are in institutions, the academics of girls who are in institutions. Those are niche problems. Those you can't solve at scale. Those you need people to go and intervene, bunch of small people by bunch of small people. My worry about the scale discussion is that it never surfaces that there are some things that scale interventions will not be able to achieve.
Correct.
And I'm not talking about quality. I will cast no aspersions on the quality of Educate Girls' work or Pratham or Magic Bus or Cry or any of these guys. I'm sure all the work they do at scale is also, you know, reasonable quality.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that work will, by virtue of being standardized, leave out certain people. Just like government policy does. This, it's the same funda. Now, those people who are getting left out, right, because of the at-scale interventions, which work, there's not a problem with them.
Yeah.
But they don't work for the kids with disability. Let's just take that. So will you not then invest in organizations that work with kids with disability? Or will you not do it just because it's 2 of every 100? And those 2 you can let go. That's the question. For me, that's the question.
Yeah, you know? That's a very, very, very interesting way to look at it. And something I actually completely agree with, because what it's essentially doing is it's almost like a it's like, you know, casting a sieve and trying to catch as many as you can. But the few that are let go or like we miss out completely, it's okay because, you know, we've achieved 98 out of 100 or something like that.
Yeah.
Which shouldn't be the case when you're looking at, you know, trying to uplift children all around the country, especially. And when it comes to maybe pulling back a conversation that we had earlier, and I know I'm just jumping topics here, but something that I found interesting was the conversation about the middle class and how often what we see in society being replicated or aspirational is what the middle class and the upper middle class, upper class of the society, you know, accomplish or do on a daily basis. So maybe taking a step back from, you know, you wearing your hat as a CEO of STCI, maybe what do you think, as someone who has such immense experience in this space and sector, should the middle class, the average middle class person, be doing so that the ripple effects of it are felt on the rest of the society?
I don't know. I don't know. I think, you know, there's a, there has been for really long a discussion on empathy and on reaching out. I actually, it's Harsh Mandar has this book called Looking Away, and he talks about this, that the middle class has become so used to seeing things around them that they just look away, and he sees that as a lack of empathy among the elite in India. And he's saying, if it were not that, how would it be okay with us to know that outside my building, not 100 meters away, a family has gone to sleep possibly without proper food?
Right.
You know, how would that be okay? So I think, and he, Harsh Mandar, and a whole bunch of other people have been talking about this now for many, many years. It's the liberal humanitarian perspective on what we need to do as the elite in India, right? Which is to reach out. I mean, this is why philanthropy suddenly in India has become so big, and it's a good thing. It's nice. It's nice to be able to see that happening. But I know many friends of mine, for example, who would say that this is all just like softy. And yeah, actually what we really need to do is to have like a mini bloodless revolution, you know, and talk about basic equity. For example, can we just do one thing? Can we just have a common school system? Right? Just that. Can we just all campaign for that? Or can we just all campaign for a certain kind of meal to be given to all children in education, no matter which school they go to? You know? So I think that the empathy point is something that as an individual and as a family or as people, we can always keep working on. But at this level of the system, there is radical work that can be done if we have the political will to do it. And that can be basic, you know, can be equity based.
Right.
For everybody, irrespective of who you are. Even the notion of a universal income, right? A universal basic income. Yeah. Where is that idea coming from? So where's Jodhres coming from? They're all coming from the same place. To say if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me. Well, I don't know if we have the moral fiber to say that as a people. It's tough to live, no?
Yeah.
And I'm not even saying for everything. I'm just saying, let's say primary education.
Correct.
Yeah, if it's good enough for your let's say primary education and the midday meal, are we okay with that? Even hospital care, I mean, we have right now it's just each to his own, right? Tumhare paas bus hai to tum karo, nahi hai to mat karo. It's that. If it's that, then it cannot, then it's not about human rights, right? If I have to buy it, then it's not about human rights. If it accrues to me by virtue of being alive, then it's human rights. So I think we have to, as a class and as a people, accept that some things are not about tum acche banoge tab tumko milega. You know, that's not the case.
And that's a very simplistic notion as well, right? Like, okay, if you work harder, you do well and you do good, you'll get all these things. It's usually not the case because there are so many environmental factors and so many inherent factors, right? Like caste and you know, where you're born and the kind of environment or access that you're given that influence what social mobility you have, or if at all any mobility. And unfortunately, especially amongst the elites, we find ourselves caught in that constant conversation about whether or not reservations should be allowed, or whether or not it's okay to elevate other people to the level that you are. Because I feel like there is that kind of comfort in exclusivity, or aspirational aspect in exclusivity, which is a disturbing thought. Yeah.
But yeah, it is disturbing. But at least, you know, Anurag, you say it like it is. We're getting to a time, I remember being in school, of course, I'm much older, but I remember being in school or college and having these conversations, but I don't hear a lot of those conversations among millennials much. You know, and I think it's because of the world that we have built in which they've been born into. Correct. Where you're aspiring to be, you know, Steve Jobs, that Musk fellow. You know, all these people, you know, and the thing that excites me right now is that in the last 6 months, the role models have changed, you know, from your Jacinda Ardern to the Finnish Prime Minister, and you know, all these women who are just showing that leadership can be different, and hopefully something will come of that. I mean, internationally, I'm speaking here, but in India as well, I hope that this is, for me, I think that's a big hope, you know, if we just, of all the work that the development sector has done with young people over the last many years, if there are 5, 10 leaders who come forth and just show that leadership can be different, I think, you know, we'll have somewhere to go.
But Havovi, before I let you go, just want to ask you again, maybe if you had a blank slate, you can look at the world in as optimistic a way that you can. In 10 years' time, what is your dream for children, adolescents, girls in our country, in India?
I think the big dream is playgrounds for every child. You know, girls, children with disability, children in institutions, no matter where they are. So playgrounds for every child. I wish every child many stories to read. Again, in whatever language they want and whichever story they want to read. And I wish for every child many stories to write. I think that this is a really romantic notion, but you know, I think that these are the things which will, these are big things for childhood. These are big things, you know. It's a period of creativity and play, and I think we should just ensure that you have the capacity and the space to read and write, imagine, play, create. You know, these are really important things. This is what I want for every single child, and it goes without saying, you know, that you want every child to have nurturing relationships. Whether they are with adults or with other children, relationships where they can nurture and relationships where they can be nurtured. And then I want those. I mean, for me, like, a common school system is a dream. And I'm so proud to be in this sector because I know so many people haven't let go of that dream yet, you know. So I think something like that would be absolutely foundational to a just world. And I hope that it doesn't completely die out.